Howdy. Thanks for listening to Let the Movie Speak. Before we get started, we'd like to ask a favor of you.
It's a simple favor. If you could just rate and review our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen, that might help other ears get into our ecosystem here and hear another episode. Anyway, enjoy the show.
You see, there's an answer for everything.
Madeline. Try. Try for me.
Let the movie speak.
Welcome back, everybody. This is another episode of Let the Movie Speak. My name's Travis, and that's it, because Justin couldn't be with us tonight, unfortunately. We're wishing him the best and hoping he listens. And hi, Justin. Hi.
Hi, Justin.
And there's a voice from not the heavens, but from your ears, and that means one thing.
We've got Annie.
Yeah.
Hi, Annie. How's it going?
I am so happy to be here, although missing Justin.
Yes. We had planned on you coming anyway for this episode. So now I have, if it was just me sitting alone in a room talking about Vertigo, I think our very healthy listenership would plummet by the minute. So thanks for being here.
And you would just get a lot of worried texts.
Yeah. People would be like, is everything okay? Everything's fine. I saw Vertigo, so it must be. Okay. Speaking of the theme song, your theme song, which we wrote, scored, and recorded exclusively for you, can't be heard anywhere else.
I'm really impressed how you changed your voice for that little moment.
It definitely won't be like copyright striking us at any point for playing that.
Never.
I took my kids last Friday to see Annie on stage.
Did they like it?
They loved it. And it was really good. And they fell asleep. They almost fell asleep at the end of Act One. So I had to load them up with Coke in the middle. But then they watched Act Two. But it did remind me that theater audiences are just terrible these days.
I mean, we have bemoaned this off mic, but yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we saw To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes.
And people sucked.
And people were smacking on popcorn and dropping glass bottles in a live theater.
And I think a hearing aid was squealing.
Like, it was.
Which that one is the least offensive because it's like, the person doesn't hear.
The person doesn't know.
What are you going to do?
Yeah, no, that was bad.
Yeah. And so this audience was annoying in different ways, but the play was good and the kids loved it. It was their first like Broadway level thing.
Was the end scary like in the 78 one?
No. Okay. No, because in the movie, see, back to movies, this is a movie podcast. So we're talking about plays. In the movie, they put that whole like climb up the bridge. It's not in the play.
Good.
It's all cut down in a way that makes way more sense on stage.
Mm-hmm.
Where they just like, I don't know, they catch him in.
Tim Curry's not trying to murder a child.
Yeah. On a bridge.
On a bridge.
Yeah. Yeah. No. They're just like in the mansion and they're like, we caught ya. Sing the final song. It's like, that's all you need.
How does the 90s one end?
Okay, my kids have watched this, but I kind of ignored it because I didn't think it was good. Although Kathy Bates is in it, right?
Well, you know.
But yeah. No,
I mean, I like Kathy Bates.
There's some rabid Annie fan who listens to the show who's like, they're not getting it. I'll tell them how it ends. I don't know.
Oh.
It's got some other redheaded kid.
I'm not worried about it. So when
A real dog, and the dog was awesome.
Well, there's a real dog in the 78 one too, Sandy.
That's a movie.
Can I?
I'm saying there's a real dog
on the stage.
Yeah. No. I'm not amazed they put a dog in a movie. I'm amazed they put a dog on stage and the dog. It was a good dog. It was such a good dog.
Okay, I have a piece of trivia about my life. I don't think you know.
Okay.
The week or month I was born, the Annie soundtrack was the top selling album.
Oh, okay.
On some chart. I forget which one.
Is that why you were named your name?
No, but everyone thought I was.
Yeah.
I was actually named after my great grandmother. Much, much less interesting. But
she's way less interesting than the fictional character Annie from Annie.
But But
was she even an orphan?
Are you talking? Back on track. Okay. So it was very, very popular in the public zeitgeist or whatever. I went to preschool.
Yeah.
And my best friend in preschool was named Sandy.
Oh,
and I am not making it up.
That's the dog's
and
name.
And then she was mad that she was the dog. But we were four and we got over it.
We got over it as four-year-olds get over things.
Exactly.
Very quickly, as I can attest to. Okay, well, we're going to talk about our final film of the 1950s. It's the end of this series for us, and it's weirdly, it's a big movie, but it's only really a big movie now, and it wasn't really a big movie then.
No, I have I learned a lot about that.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to talk about it.
Yeah. I would say this is a Citizen Kane level movie for many, many people. And I don't remember, you just watched Citizen Kane not that long ago. We didn't do that in our 40s series, but like, was Citizen Kane super highly regarded when it came out, or did it have that long shelf life?
Think it was,
people liked it then.
I think people valued it when it came out.
I think so. I should know that. I host a movie podcast. But, anyway, this one definitely wasn't that way. It's Alfred Hitchcock's Vertigo from 1958. So we'll get into that in a couple minutes, but first let's talk about what we watched this week. I have a what did I watch this week that I think somewhat transitions well into Vertigo. I don't know if you do, but do you want to start
sure.
it off? What did you watch this week?
I watched, I was going to call it a Greta Gerwig movie. I guess it sort of is. Frances Ha.
Okay.
Which was the movie that first made me aware of Greta Gerwig. She stars and wrote it.
Yeah.
And she's in a long-term relationship with Noah Baumbach. Baumbach.
Who
directed and co-wrote and produced. So they, as a couple, kind of made this movie. And
I didn't know they were a thing. I don't know about celebrity couples, but that's make sense together.
I learned it when I went to see how much influence she had in making the movie.
Gotcha.
So I've seen Little Women and I've seen Lady Bird, which I loved.
Yep.
And so I was like, I'll check out this Frances Ha thing. And I made notes. And then I have to remember what I wrote.
It's on the thing you wrote.
It's on the post-it I'm looking at. you know, I think what Greta Gerwig is really good at is creating immersive experiences where you kind of lose yourself into in the world building. She builds incredible worlds.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in Little Women, that was sweet and delightful, and Chalamet was bopping around.
Yep, he's in there.
He's in there. And then Lady Bird, I loved. I think you haven't seen Lady Bird.
I watched it.
Oh, you
I actually,
did? Okay.
Since the last time we talked about it, and you were like, I think you just watched Little Women, and you were like, I love Lady Bird. And Little Women was very good.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, I got to watch Lady Bird. And I liked Lady Bird.
Yeah.
But I think I liked Little Women a little more. I don't really know why.
Is it just because it has a better score?
Well, that doesn't hurt. But I think that the, I don't know. I think that the ending of Lady Bird bummed me out. And I know it's kind of designed to end in a very melancholy way.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember specifically now. I think Laurie Metcalf is so amazing in that movie. And so is Saoirse Ronan. But like, I was just like, I just want them to have one, like, smile, and I wanted one of those in a movie fraught with, like, you know, a coming of age, angsty teenager mom trying her best, like all of that working so well. I just, like, one scene at the end, I wanted them to just be like, it's okay, you know, and hug, and she does not give it to you. The last scene you get with Laurie Metcalf is her like driving away just with like a tear streaming down her face.
I hadn't thought about this, but I wonder if, so Lady Bird, I have a feeling, is very biographical of Greta Gerwig. I think Frances Ha is also. So I think Frances Ha is about Greta Gerwig's 20s.
Okay.
And Lady Bird's around about her teens. So if you, like, I watched them backwards, but if you watched Frances Ha now, you might actually get that.
Some resolution. Okay.
Because
okay.
Greta Gerwig's actual parents play her parents.
Oh, that's weird.
In the movie. And she goes back to Sacramento and, like,
it's Sacramento again.
Sacramento,
so it must
again.
Be, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so actually you might get some of that resolution in Frances Ha.
As we all do in our 20s, after our teens with our parents.
Well, and I think part of my issue with Little Women just goes back to the source material.
Yeah, it's not like your favorite book ever.
It's not my favorite book, and I think Laurie is problematic as a character.
Which one? Oh, the boy. Yeah.
Which our students who love Timothée Chalamet with every core.
They don't know how to separate.
No, and they're like, how dare you?
Well, and that's the thing is like, yes, I agree. Because he's so like hot right now. Mm-hmm. He's so the it dude.
Yeah.
And he's a good actor.
Yeah.
Like, I think he's fine. I think he's pretty good as Laurie.
Yeah.
But they cannot go gaga over Timothée Chalamet's cheekbones mm-hmm. without looking at the character and being like, kind of not a good person, though. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. No. Some of the students we both know have looked at me like I have... just
two heads when you're like, but the character
speared them in their souls.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not criticizing Chalamet. Yeah. I am criticizing Louisa May Alcott.
Yeah.
But anyway, I think, Frances Ha, she made this one before either of those mm-hmm. and it shows, you know, it's a little,
younger feeling.
It's all black and white. It's mm-hmm. like trying to create nostalgia, but you get it. It's like people creating nostalgia for 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Like it's people in their 30s creating nostalgia about their 20s. And, you know, this is about, it's basically a coming of age story, except the main character is 27 instead of 17.
Okay.
And, you know, she's a chaotic, lost, big ideas, no practical skills.
Yeah.
Like woman loose in the creative arts in New York. And my story is way too close to that.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like I've been the chaotic, lost, big idea, no ground under my feet, 20 something. Like mm-hmm. I've been her. So like there were moments watching this movie where I was just like, no.
Stop doing that.
So no, I think it was lovely.
Okay.
I don't know if it's your cup of tea necessarily watching a 27-year-old dancer like find her identity in New York City. And occasionally Sacramento.
Yeah.
But
nothing photographs like Sacramento.
But yeah, anyway, it's beautifully shot. It's a good movie that I would recommend to people who aren't you.
My buddy who past guest, Gary Moore, who is on our The Grand Illusion episode, is a huge cinematography nerd.
Mm-hmm.
It's like he's an editor and a mm-hmm. cinematographer. Nerd. Hi, Gary, if you're listening. He will never stop recommending this movie to me. He loves this movie.
You should see it. It's all black and white, so it's doing some interesting things.
I like Noah Baumbach. Have you seen much of...
No.
Okay. Like The Squid and the Whale, and he did that thing on Netflix with like Ben Stiller and Dustin Hoffman that actually looked really... Meyerowitz Stories, whatever mm-hmm. that is. And then Marriage Story, which I really liked.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Which is a bummer. Mm-hmm. A bummer movie that's really good. You know?
Yeah.
Okay. Frances Ha, check it out or don't. I've been rewatching a lot because I'm gonna give up a couple streaming services soon, and so I'm like trying to load up before they expire. And HBO Max is one of those that's gonna go bye-bye for a while, and it has The Grand Budapest Hotel,
right?
It also has The French Dispatch, which is Wes Anderson's new movie.
Oh, okay.
I haven't watched yet. I'll probably try to watch that before it expires. So I rewatched The Grand Budapest. I saw this movie in theaters. This is 2014, I think, when I saw it. And I was like worshiping the ground mm-hmm. it walked on for a while. Probably because if you see that movie in a theater, it's like, it's so... Mm-hmm. Wes Anderson like is so weird and good about just... like still frame visual good looking things.
Yeah.
Like it's so weird to watch one of his movies. I think because everything looks so pretty and specific, like mm-hmm. a fully realized aesthetic. This mm-hmm. guy has nothing else other than things that are sort of aping it look like a Wes Anderson frame, let alone a scene or a whole movie or a sequence. And so it's so nice to look at. And the cast is good. Like it's got a lot of amazing people in it, like F. Murray Abraham and Ralph Fiennes and who's the guy? You know, the guy. Jude Law. And all these like good actors, just like this is what Wes Anderson does. He just scrapes all these people into this crazy big ensemble cast. And then it's a sprawling kind of story. My problem with it now, having watched it on the small screen, and that may be the only difference, is it's like... so particularly constructed But I feel like the storytelling is really antiseptic feeling. Mm-hmm. It's really like there's people feeling things in a Wes Anderson movie is like this scene between F. Murray Abraham and Jude Law where he is like, he's the narrator, the sort of storytelling device. They're sitting down to dinner and he tells the whole story. And then you flash to a bunch of stuff. And then occasionally they'll flash back to those two back in the future or whatever. And they cut back to him at one point. He's telling a part of the story about the woman he loves, Saoirse Ronan, and as a younger boy or whatever. And he, it's a Jude Law's character says like, and then he stopped and I looked up and he had pushed his meal aside. And I just asked him finally, are you okay? And a tear rolled down his face. And like, it's like the, it's probably the most emotional moment in the whole movie. And it's literally like F. Murray Abraham sitting there with one tear and no, like, crying, acting, no, it's just so like, and then he cried.
Yeah.
And
it's
so
a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah. And so I feel like what that stuff that like when I was maybe getting more into film nerdery, like at that time, when the movie came out, I was like so blown away by the visuals and the direction, which are all amazing, that like, I didn't really, the stuff that maybe resonates with me more now than it did 10-ish years ago is like, I don't know. Yeah, it looks really good, but like nothing in that story made me feel much of anything at all or will stick with me. Yeah. And then I watched that and I'm like, I think this was my favorite Wes Anderson movie. It's like, oh shoot. If I go back and I watch any Wes Anderson movie like The Royal Tenenbaums or Life Aquatic or any of those that I really liked, am I going to feel the same way? Is it just going to be like funny, quirky, but like there's no real heart in any of it for me? I don't know.
So I've seen many of them up through probably, I think Royal Budapest might have been my last one.
Royal Budapest?
Whatever, I just...
Grand Royal Tenenbaum Budapest.
Exactly. Or Life Aquatic, that was probably before.
This is a submarine one.
It's
the one with the aquatic those were stuff kind of, in it.
we're good. Those were probably like the last two I saw. I loved Royal Tenenbaums.
Yeah, I
loved that one.
It's about a family.
And in my mind, in my very faded memory, that one had a little more heart to it.
I feel like it did too, because again, it's like it's all about a family and there's family dynamic stuff. And it is still Wes Anderson.
Right.
So like quirky to the max, but...
But I just feel like as he went on, he got more and more focused on his exceptional visuals.
Yeah.
And...
Geometry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like the quirkiness of it and kind of the people, the characters got more and more robotic or one dimensional.
Have you seen Bottle Rocket? The first one, it's got.
Remind me. I think I did.
Owen Wilson and probably Jason Schwartzman.
Okay. So that knocks it down to half of his movies.
Yeah. Or all like a million of them. Yeah. I don't know. I that's the one that's like indie.
Right.
His breakout before he made like big budget things. And I'm just wondering like it, cause it's smaller. Because like you watch The Grand Budapest and you're like, oh, he had all the money.
Yeah.
You know, it's like huge, crazy set pieces and all the A-list actors. And like the last movie he made is the same level of production that I just wonder, like, if I watch the French Dispatch, am I going to feel one thing?
What was the one? That one did not land for me.
Yeah.
I watched that and went like, I am not a better person for these 2 hours. So I think that's when he started losing me around there. But again, because he started feeling like he was doing the same thing in each movie.
A little one note
and a little like, no, I know you can do this. I've seen you do this 10 times now. It's awesome.
Do you have feelings though? That's what I want to know. Like even like Scorsese, like there's, you know, he's or Kubrick, like you watch a Kubrick movie and it's like people nail him to the wall for being like cold and clinical, but it's like, well, yeah, but like, look at Shelley Duvall in The Shining. And it's like, she's like losing all of her emotions in order to give that performance. And I don't know. Mm-hmm. It was weird. It was a weird rewatch. And it's still a good movie, but I don't know. I don't think I loved it as much on the small screen. Maybe that's all it boils down to. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is the most smooth segue ever.
Okay.
Grand Budapest Hotel has lots of interesting colors.
You're so smooth.
So smooth.
It does.
There's lots of interesting
exceptional colors.
It's a very interesting palette. Vertigo also has colors. So in the intro section, we're going to name every color in the movie.
Ruby, red, emerald, green. I'm done.
Yeah. Those two are big. Gray. Her suit is gray. Mm-hmm. His suit is gray. The car is also green.
Yeah.
His car is white. And there are other colors. Vertigo is Hitchcock's quote-unquote masterpiece, as like recorded by many, many publications and lists and people nowadays. But it came out in 1958, and I just wanted to double-check his filmography to look at the time frame here. This is pre-Psycho. This is pre-North by Northwest, and it's post things like, you know, Rope, Rebecca, what else? What other thing?
Rear Window.
Rear Window.
Because this is the last movie that he made with Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, for reasons.
Yeah.
Which are interesting. Mm-hmm. So Jimmy Stewart's in this movie. If you didn't know that Jimmy Stewart's in Vertigo, I don't know how you find yourself to this podcast and clicked play, but he is. And then it also obviously stars Kim Novak. And as far as big name actors go, it's one of those like twofers because it's those two. And then some character actors and not a big cast in general. The things to note on this one are the reception of the movie and I would say like influence from here on out and some of the visuals. But storytelling wise, I think you could make the argument that this is like kind of an old story and kind of a new story. And like it's not like something like Psycho, which is like invented a genre. Like slasher movies wouldn't exist if Hitchcock didn't make Psycho. Vertigo is a kind of ghost story for a while. Yeah,
well, and I think we may get into this more, but Hemingway. Hitchcock wasn't very interested in the story.
Yeah.
And I think that shows.
Yeah.
Like, he's not here to tell a brisk and, you know, taut story.
He's done that.
Yeah.
He's done that. Like if you like, well, what did we, the 39 steps is mm-hmm. something that like goes bam, bam, plot, plot, plot. They go all over the world and there's twists and turns mm-hmm. and like, it's not that story. Mm-hmm. It is, if you want to be mean, you could say meandering. Mm-hmm. And if you wanted to be nice, you could say like meditative and evocative and like, mm-hmm. it's one of those two things, depending on if you like it or not, I guess. So how many times have you seen Vertigo? When's the last time you saw it? What's your,
Before this week, I think it may have been, let's just say I don't remember.
Okay.
It's been that long. So, speaking of Budapest, I lived there once.
Yeah.
And,
me too, by the way, obviously.
And, when I lived there, I lived about 3 blocks away from one of 2 English language video stores mm-hmm. in the country of Hungary.
Wow.
Which meant in the winter.
Humble brag.
Well, sure. Which meant in the winter when the sun went down at 4 and rose at 9, my roommate and I spent a lot of time frequenting the English language video store.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a lot, but they had all of the Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And so we did we watched all the Hitchcock.
So you saw it from a video store, which is interesting because this is one of like 5 movies that were like not available for decades because
they came back in 84.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it would have been about the time because they didn't have DVDs mm-hmm. back then. Mm-hmm. They would have gone out of theaters and then like didn't go into syndication, like never played mm-hmm. on TV or whatever. And it's because these rights got signed over to his daughter. Then they had to work it out mm-hmm. in court, blah, 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 whatever. Anyway, when VHS tapes were starting to boom, these were all like back on the market. And so I remember just a thing about Hitchcock. My mom is a huge Jimmy Stewart fan and a big Hitchcock fan. There was a very specific VHS series of these that was like the Hitchcock signatures and they all had the same mm-hmm. spine with like his little silhouette and everything mm-hmm. on it. And that same like weird, tall, skinny white script with like Rope and like,
So
well, and you probably saw those in Hungary.
That's probably what I was watching.
Yeah.
So of the, four of the 5,
yeah.
At least 3 of them were Jimmy Stewart movies because it was Rope and it was Rear Window.
I think The Man
and
in
Who Vertigo. Knew
Too Much was one of them too.
Is that Jimmy Stewart?
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Okay.
It's not Cary Grant.
I just don't know.
One or the other.
So I just find it interesting that the movies that disappeared for 30 years or whatever it was were
he signed away all of the Jimmy Stewart.
He signed away the Jimmy Stewart ones.
Yeah, that's really weird. But we can talk about exactly why that is. Let's just talk about it now, because we'll talk about that, which is, I don't know, it's not really controversy. It's just the reception of the movie was not good. And critics at the time just sort of hailed it as style over substance, slow. And it just wasn't, people didn't like it.
No, they did not.
And I think probably because of one of the things you're describing, which is it's not a like Dial In for Murder type of story in the slightest.
No,
not even a little bit, like a whodunit or anything like that. Although it kind of finds its way into a couple of those tropes, maybe you could say, at the end. But a few other things that matter about it. One is technical and nerdy, but it must be said. The shot that you all know from something. The two examples that pop to mind are Jaws, when Roy Scheider realizes that the shark is there or whatever.
It's attacking someone in the water.
Yes. There's a very famous shot of his face, but it looks really warped and funky. And that is a you could call it like a dolly zoom or a contra zoom. Some people call it the trombone shot, because I guess the way you actually move the camera and then you move it backwards and focus it forwards or vice versa to get that effect was invented for this movie.
Well, there's controversy.
Oh yeah. Okay. That's true. Because this was done on miniatures or something. And
well, and there was like one movie that didn't have nearly as much press, a much smaller film that did the same thing a few years earlier, but it may have even been not an American film.
I think that's true. There was a foreign film that executed it before this. And but
this is the one that gets the credit for it.
Yes. And that, I think the reason for that is because Hitchcock had like written down there's some historical record. He had this idea as far back as like Rebecca. He was like, we could do this. And he got the idea from like falling over, fainting, like at a party or something like that. And the blurred vision he got made him think like, oh, if we could pull this off.
Right.
But they couldn't do it with the equipment in like the 40s. And so, I don't know, whatever. Mm-hmm. It made that shot famous, let's
say.
Yes,
it did.
Even if it didn't. And it's used, I think, really to good effect in here, like a couple, a few times for express purpose, which is, you know, vertigo. what is it actually called? Vertigo's not the real...
Well, vertigo is what he's feeling. It's that, it's dizziness. And vertigo is like...
What's the...
Acrophobia.
Acrophobia.
Is the fear of heights.
Arachnophobia.
That's the fear of spiders. Spiders.
Okay, so that happened, and that's important. What you were alluding to, why did Alfred Hitchcock stop making movies with Jimmy Stewart after this movie? It's funny and petty and stupid.
It is dumb. So, as you said, the movie was not well received, and not just by critics, but by popular audiences as well. And I don't think that's because of Jimmy Stewart, but Hitchcock did.
He did. He said as much.
Hitchcock was just like, nobody wants to see you because you're old now.
Yeah, he said he looked too old.
Yeah.
And then he was too old to be the romantic lead.
Which is like, well, you cast me, dude.
For like the fifth time.
Exactly. So I don't think that people rejected this because of Jimmy Stewart, probably.
No, I don't think so.
I think it's just because it's rambling. And Hitchcock is also on record that he cared more about the visuals and the use of new technology.
The Kim Novak anecdote, right? Where she had some ideas about her character's costume, and then surprise, surprise, you show up for Hitchcock's Vertigo and he's like, you're wearing this.
Yeah. And she was like, you're the director. Why do you care what I wear? Yeah. And I'm like, do you know who you're talking to?
But also, I mean, what's interesting, this is an interesting kind of clash of like big time stars, right? Because Hitchcock was like the biggest director at this point, and he hadn't even made Psycho yet. And Kim Novak was a huge movie star, so much so that she like didn't show up to work one day because she was striking for higher pay, and then it worked.
Yeah, exactly.
A woman in 1958 just decided,
24-year-old woman.
Yes, I'm not going to go to work until you pay me more, and then they did.
Yeah.
So both of these people had sway and, you know, opinions and artistic vision. I'm sure you can roll all that into one. And Hitchcock was crazy.
Yeah.
And so yeah, that clash is interesting to me for a couple of reasons. One, because it was like a realization moment for her in prepping for the character that like, oh, this guy is cray cray. He's super meticulous and wants everything perfect. And also because if you watch the movie, there are some there's some autobiographical parallels between being very particular about clothing.
I wonder if one of the reasons that audiences didn't love this is because Jimmy Stewart's not a great guy.
Right.
And, you know, had he been Tom Hanks at this point, mm-hmm. where everyone assumed he was good. Now,
a little bit.
He wasn't a good guy in Rope. If I'm going to spoil the second Thin Man.
Okay. So I was hoping you were going to bring this up because now I've watched it.
Jump ahead. If you don't want the second Thin Man movie spoiled, he's the bad guy. He's the murderer. This is why I was pushing you for so long to watch this movie, because you recorded Rope and you were like, this is so weird. He's the bad guy. I'm like, you have to watch. He shoots people.
I'm so stupid.
He tries to
shoot. You probably said that every time I was talking about Rope. You were like, okay, but watch the second Thin Man. And okay, I was like, fine, I'll get to it.
And like, I was like, Jimmy Stewart's in it.
Dude. Yeah. No, I was thinking the exact same thing. Because that's three examples I can think of, and not small movies.
But those are both a long time ago, right? Like, he's super young in The Thin Man.
I guess the question is, can he do a bad guy or a complicated, mm-hmm. flawed character, mm-hmm. after It's a Wonderful Life?
Well, that's, yes.
Right? I mean, and Rope would be, what, just after that? Is that right?
It would be interesting to find out when It's a Wonderful Life became It's a Wonderful Life. Like
that's,
when
that's
did
another
it,
one of those, right?
When did it get that cultural cachet? Because
not right away, too.
Well, because I would think it would be when it starts getting played on TV every Christmas.
Yeah, because it bombed. Like, It's a Wonderful Life was a bomb. And then it got popular when the rights expired and every cable TV station picked it up for free and was able to play it around Christmas time. And then it became a Christmas classic and people were like, oh, this is actually an amazing movie. Okay, so let's just look at Jimmy Stewart's time frame a little bit.
So he's a good guy in Rear Window.
He is a good guy in Rear Window. So, sorry, I'm going from 1950. Harvey, 1950, which we covered. Good guy.
Right.
Bunch of stuff I don't know what it is. Glenn Miller, good guy. Rear Window, good 54, guy. Good guy. But that's a Hitchcock. Man Who Knew Too Much, good guy. And then you hit Vertigo in 1958. So this is way after It's a Wonderful Life. And it's after Rope.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some precedent, but I guess the question is, do people want that Jimmy Stewart?
Right. And so I think if they're rejecting Jimmy Stewart, I don't think it's because he's a silver fox.
He's got wrinkles on his forehead.
No, yeah. I think it's because they don't want to see him shove Kim Novak around and be a terrible human to her.
Yeah, and cheat on his friend.
Yeah.
You know, so weird reception, but it's obviously grown to acclaim. Like we all know that now in the year 2023 of our Lord. 2020 and 2012, it replaced Citizen Kane as the best movie of all time in the Sight and Sound poll, which is a yearly, like they, you know what Sight and Sound? It's like,
I know them. It's a publication.
Yes. And directors put in a ballot. Like you have to be selected to fill out a ballot and then they aggregate all those ballots. And that's how, it's not just like some rando sample size of the population.
Right.
It's like filmmakers.
People who know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Do you think it's better than Citizen Kane?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's a very different movie. Right. I think I probably like it about as much as Citizen Kane. Like, mm-hmm. Citizen Kane's great, but I think this is
great. For rewatchability, I think I would rewatch
probably.
Citizen Kane first.
Yeah.
But I think that also just has to do with the creep factor. Like,
oh, there's creep.
There's creep in this one.
Yeah, like Citizen Kane's about an imperfect protagonist, and it's very, I'm going to say dense, but not in a bad way.
Right.
You know, there's a lot there.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't call this dense
because
not a lot happens, but it is, it's in some ways more cinematic in its mm-hmm. storytelling. You know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. Citizen Kane could have been made 10 years before, 10 years after. It's just an amazing script
mm-hmm.
and an amazing execution, but like it doesn't look like Vertigo.
Well, no. And what they're doing in Citizen Kane, what Orson Welles is doing in Citizen Kane is more about camera angles and framing and things that don't necessarily take technology to achieve.
Yeah. And it's older. So it's not apples to apples, but I don't know. I think I would rewatch Citizen Kane more times before I die, but I would probably say that they're about the same amount mm-hmm. of good, mm-hmm. whatever that means. Okay. A couple interesting facts, and then we'll move on to the plot of the movie and talk about what's it saying. They spent 16 days in San Francisco to film this movie.
Okay, I read that, and that didn't sound like a lot.
That didn't sound real. No, that sounds insanely low.
Yeah.
Because everything looks... Okay, we live 40 minutes from San Francisco proper, the city. We've been there a billion times.
These are all places we recognize.
Every single street almost I could like pinpoint. And
although, can you make the traffic be like that now, please?
Seriously. Yeah, you could drive in San Francisco. it's incredible that they did, because it's clear that, one, they did a ton in 16 days.
Yeah.
And they did a lot of really good fakery.
Yes,
like
they did.
Incredibly convincing fakery. And it's not like they had like all the green screen, you know, technology in the world to do it with. Last thing I have here is that it was only nominated for 2 Oscars, art direction and sound, which is kind of, I mean, I get it. Like,
so we'll talk about the use of color and how the use of color is amazing, but is that art direction? Like,
Well,
who gets credit for the incredible use of color in this film?
I mean, I think art direction is the art director's a specific role on the cast and crew, but you also have, you know, a cinematographer who typically gets credit for lighting choices because the lighting designer and the DP work together. I don't really know. I'm just wondering of this year, what else do we have? This is the 59-year.
I mean, this isn't going to be getting acting Oscars. Nobody's getting nominated for acting. In this
I guess. I mean, if it was a better received movie, you could see it's Jimmy Stewart. It's like when Tom Hanks is in a movie that people like, he gets nominated. You know, not that he's not good. He's kind of always good.
Yeah. My question is, does bad guy Jimmy Stewart or creeper Jimmy Stewart?
Probably not. So Gigi, Bell Book and Candle.
So that's art direction.
A Certain Smile. I mean, these are things that went
MAME
up against.
MAME's amazing. So
Separate Tables. I don't know what that is. No. That won a lot of things. David Niven won an Oscar for that movie. I've down talked David Niven so much on this podcast.
No,
Cat on a Hot Tin Roof is good.
Yeah.
Old Man in the Sea.
David Niven is a really good stand-in person. He's kind of a mannequin. I'm sorry, David Niven, if you can hear me.
Yeah.
In the afterlife.
A mannequin with a pulse.
He just can stand there and be handsome, and that's about what he's good for.
I'm going to go ahead and go out on a limb and say, unless Gigi is the best movie ever made, it's a kind of a weak year. It's not. There's not a lot happening here. And even then, something like Vertigo, you could see getting nominated for maybe one acting spot. Director. I mean, come on. Like, director is the one that doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's the background to Vertigo. I've seen Vertigo probably like 4 times. I haven't seen it in, I probably haven't watched it in like 5 or more years. So it's been a while. So let's get into what's it saying. Okay, so we already talked about it. It's a bad Jimmy Stewart, but the reasons he is bad are, I think, they're kind of complicated. I'm not going to justify his behavior at any specific moment, but I think what's interesting about the story is it starts out in the procedural Hitchcock world, which he's done kind of over and over again. And the character is then like, it's like the end of the character's normal movie, and then some other movie takes over, and it's freaking weird.
Yes.
Like that's why we say it's not like a twisty turny whodunit kind of a movie, because there's like pieces of that kind of a story in here, but they're like a little bit at the beginning and a little bit at the end, and everything in the middle is like a dream, like it's totally dreamy.
Yeah.
But the first thing that catches your eye is the freaking credits. Like the minute that like the eyeball pops up on screen and everything, and it's like Technicolor, Panavision, whatever.
Well, it was the first credits to use computer animation of some sort.
Yeah, because Saul Bass, who would go on to do like a lot of famous title sequences and posters and stuff, really like anything you see of like 60s poster art that looked.
Did he do Bond?
Yeah, he did.
Because it's very, this is just, looks like the same creator as the Bond titles.
Yeah, he did the Bond stuff. He did, like, if you look at Bell Book and Candle, which is another Jimmy Stewart movie of this year, the, like, same silhouette, like, body that you see in the Vertigo poster, you'll find on that. Anyway, the title sequence is so mesmerizing. I think, like, back in the day, title sequences were just longer. And people took their time, and people were more used to, like, you know, patient theater-going experiences. So, like, watching the title sequence To me, it really sets up what kind of a movie it is, because it's like, I don't know how long it was, but it was like, okay, this is way longer than...
Well, they didn't have to watch like 10 movie trailers.
That's true.
Before it also.
Yeah. They were just happy to see something happening.
Like, they were still settling into their seats and like sharing their popcorn. Whereas yeah. after 10 trailers, we're finished with our popcorn.
It's so long now. Like it just, they keep adding like one. It's crazy. It's bananas. Okay. So what do you think of the opening sequence? The rooftop, it's short. The rooftop chase into the first conversation with Midge, let's say.
So this movie comes out in 58.
Correct.
And when I was watching that, like the rooftop chase, I thought, okay, this is like 60s grit.
Yeah.
You know, it's not perfected. It's not shiny. As much as the opening credits are, you know, very stylized. That looks like something you might see in Streets of San Francisco or something like that. Or mm-hmm. like where it's
almost like French Connection, which is a 70s movie, but like foot chasey.
But it's gritty.
Yeah.
It's not crisp clean. It's not highly stylized. Yeah. It is. I keep coming up with the same word.
Is it gritty?
It's gritty. and so I was thinking, I was like, oh, we are leaving the 50s.
Yeah.
That's what I thought with that.
Yeah, I think it's a really good movie for that, because like there are a lot of 60s movies that look just like Vertigo. Mm-hmm. Like I don't mean that like all movies from the 60s copied. I just mean like it ushered in some things that were just like, oh, this would become the stylistic norm. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think that's part of it. That opening foot chase doesn't feel like slick and tidy and put together. I just think it's like a really cool way to introduce the protagonist and then like mess up the audience, like mm-hmm. get them off kilter mm-hmm. right away. Cause immediately he's like, he's your sympathetic lead. He's a cop. Mm-hmm. He accidentally is involved with this other police officer mm-hmm. who falls and dies. And then in the next scene, you realize he's had some sort of recovery and mm-hmm. he's on the mend, but he has to retire because he now has a fear of heights.
Well, and it was reminding me of the opening of Rear Window, mm-hmm. where you have, you know, he's injured and he's got the window with the great view. And
yeah.
like there was a moment when I was like, wait, what am I watching?
This is a sequel?
Yeah. I didn't think I was watching the Grace Kelly one. So yeah, I saw a lot of tie-ins to the beginning of Rear Window, although it diverges quickly.
It really does. Because those are where the similarities end with Rear Window, I would say. Because it's like, yes, you have a handicapped Jimmy Stewart, and beyond that, this is not the same dude.
No. Can I just say I wanted more Midge?
She was like, great.
I was just happy whenever Midge was on screen.
I loved her.
She has
a weird name.
Belgettis, something Belgettis.
Yeah, I got it here. Barbara Bel Geddes as Midge. I thought she's a delightful human being.
Yes.
The only delightful human being in the whole movie.
And I was just like, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Why are you walking away from Midge?
Yeah.
Anyway,
she rules.
Because it's a Hitchcock movie. That's why.
Well, there's that. Yeah, so Midge, she's in a handful of scenes, but she is the character who has some history with him. They were in college together, supposedly were engaged for a little mm-hmm. while, but she broke it off.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they know each other and just like friends, but there's still something there.
Well, she's clearly still in love with him.
Yeah.
But there's something going on there.
Yeah, they've maintained a friendship and she's like come back around to him mm-hmm, or something mm-hmm. in an interesting way that mm-hmm. felt like very adult and very real to me. Mm-hmm. And so what happens quickly is he gets a call from a friend, his friend who they knew from college.
Mm-hmm.
And his friend just says, I want you to follow my wife. She leaves for a long time and I don't know where she goes.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay. So it's like a gumshoey kind of detective thing. And then someone speaks the line, do you believe that someone out of the past, someone dead, can enter and take possession of a living being? And I'm like,
and then you just feel like,
what?
That, yes, then it's an entirely different kind of show.
Okay, so I think that's the entire beginning of the movie. The whole middle section of the movie until, it's got to be like, because it's a two-hour movie, it's got to be like a good 40 minutes mm-hmm. in the middle. How would you describe how the middle 40 minutes there feels after the setup? What happens? What are all the things that happen?
There's colors.
There's lots of colors.
So Jimmy Stewart goes to a restaurant so that he can see the woman and know what she looks like so he can follow her.
Yep.
And she is in this red. The restaurants are very red. The walls are richly.
So freaking red.
So red. It's like, and just anyway, very, very red. And then you have this gorgeous platinum blonde in an emerald green spotlit shining dress in the middle of the red room. And that's her.
With like impeccable hair.
Yes.
And makeup and.
Yeah. And so, you know, from then on, he's following her and then eventually saves her and
gets. She jumps in the bay. He pulls her out.
Yeah. And he pulls her out. And what's interesting to me and what when you watch this is, I'm just going to go on the color theory thing at this point, is that you do have all of this red surrounding her, but she is green. So she's wearing the big green dress. She's driving a green car.
Yep.
And then she ends up in the bay. And Stuart's character up until then has had all the red in the restaurant, his front door is red.
Yeah.
Like that red color is around him a lot.
Yeah.
And, but he rescues her out of the bay, takes her home to his apartment, gives her his robe to wear, which is red, and he is wearing the green sweater. So he is changed into this green sweater.
Yeah.
And that is the moment when he switches sides. That is the moment when he buys in to the narrative. And that's when he is all in to try to save this girl. Like,
right.
He is now... What is protector?
What he's bought into, folks, by the way, is the husband tells him that he believes that the woman's that he's following, played by Kim Novak, Madeline, her great grandmother, who committed suicide when she was 26, has possessed her.
Well, and has possessed each woman in the family through the generations, so that they've all committed suicide.
Yes.
And so now it's like the wife is 26.
It's like a generational curse kind of.
Right. Thing. Exactly.
And some of that, and so the husband is convinced of this, and then you watch her behavior when Jimmy Stewart's tailing her like a private eye, you know, at first. And I just want to say, I think Kim Novak is so good in this movie. I think it's an undersold victory as a performance because she doesn't speak until like 45 plus minutes into the movie. And so a lot of it is like, okay, you've got Edith Head doing the costumes and they're amazing and Alfred Hitchcock shooting the crap out of it. And like, it looks incredible. So that's like maybe half the work, but also she really sells, like he says stuff like she looks different. She walks different. Mm-hmm. She talks different. Mm-hmm. So she's selling this like dreamy ghost-like quality without speaking for a long, long time. And then when she finally talks to Jimmy Stewart, you can see that there's more there, but she's like, you got to peel back the layers and they're not peeled back yet. And so after he pulls her out of the water, he buys into that freaky dicky stuff. Right. Which is like, she sounds convincing. I didn't know where I was. And then I ended up in your apartment. I was at, she says I was at the water and I must've fainted and fell in. So there's this thing where like, as he's starting to believe the ghost story, he is their hands touch. The moment where their hands touch, it's like, ah, and it's, I feel like it's like that for a couple of reasons. One, because of what you said. It's Jimmy Stewart. You don't see Jimmy Stewart do bad things. And this is his friend's wife. And I think his performance is subtle enough where like when he looks at her in the restaurant and when he's tailing her, only on a rewatch would you read into that he's like immediately infatuated with her like beauty. Like I think, right? Like you're the viewer.
Right.
Like you can't help but like look at her as a thing in the middle of a frame and be like, wow, because of how she's costume and design, and Kim Novak is gorgeous.
Right.
But like I'm watching it the first time in a while, at least trying to watch it with fresh eyes and just thinking like, I don't see Jimmy Stewart go like the wolf's eyes in cartoons, like awooga, like immediately.
And he doesn't like his role. Like he doesn't want to be, he doesn't want to be following her. He's doing this as a favor to his friend, but I think he kind of feels like of himself as a creeper. But I think what switches when he puts on the green sweater is up until then, he's just been sweet Jimmy Stewart, you know, vaguely in love with his college girlfriend, with Midge, and they're delightful together.
And non-committal though. Like
they're, yeah.
Yeah.
I read that more from him than her, but it doesn't really matter.
No, that's what I'm saying. He is non-committal. Yeah. She is like, well, stop messing around here. What are we doing? We're adults now.
Yeah. But it's still human and friendly and like, I'm like, no, those are real people. That's how real people interact.
Yes.
But the way he's interacting with Kim Novak. Like, that's not real people.
No.
No. Now we're talking about...
Both of them.
Right.
Yes, I
Ghost
agree.
Possession and obsession. And now this is not normal people anymore.
Agreed.
And he's fallen into her, like, her world.
Obsessive
of,
nature.
Yes, exactly.
And so, like, as she is obsessed with... this great grandmother who she goes and she sits and looks at her painting and she goes to the house that was built for her and she goes to see her grave. She's just like, this is what she does. This is where she goes when her husband doesn't know where she is. I do think it's really genius how Hitchcock starts to frame her in the, like, whatever, farther away background and Jimmy Stewart in the foreground of these shots.
Okay. I didn't notice
you're
that.
You're watching... he shows a shot of her sitting in front of that bench, which apparently he filmed for like 2 weeks straight to get the lighting right. Because he's
in the Legion of Honor Museum.
In the Legion of Honor, yes. And the painting is amazing.
It's not. It's terrible. Dear listener, I love the Legion of Honor Museum in San Francisco. Everyone should go
and see
the amazing art in there.
And Carlotta's there.
No, like I saw that painting, and honestly, I was naive, and I knew they were going to Legion of Honor, and. In my head, I thought they were going to use an actual piece of art.
Right.
That was good.
Right. Like Carlotta.
No. And then they showed her and I was like, oh, I've been in that room. I know that room where they shot that. And then they're like, look at the painting. And I'm like, who allowed that horror show?
It was painted by a set prop guy. Anyway, I know. It's pretty good for a prop guy.
Not get it out of my Legion of Honor.
So she's sitting there admiring the painting and then the camera like does its slow backup and then he's standing there admiring her, which is just this weird like Russian doll thing that happens visually and then it happens with the story because he falls for her, becomes obsessed with her. And I just think like when she jumps in the bay, there's this moment. And we don't have to stand it too long, but like I've read some stuff and watched some folks, you know, little video reviews of the movie just to get a sense of like, what do people think this movie's saying? Does it line up with what I'm saying? People freak out about this whole like he takes her home and her clothes are off and he's in her bed thing. And I'm like,
she's in his bed.
That's what I meant to say.
He is still fully clothed and not in his bed.
Right. And so like, I think the movie works for me because it's not purely predatory, like their relationship. Like he is crossing lines.
Yeah.
Like he is crossing lines of like professionalism and duty and friendship and morality. And like, but this is not a movie about a guy who exerts his power in order to like brainwash someone.
No, no.
Not by the time you get to the end. So the moment with the clothes where it's like, oh, he took her clothes. She was going to die of hypothermia.
Yeah.
And so that's how you make someone not die.
Yeah. well, and I think if we look at it from knowing the end.
Yes.
Then I feel like his actions are far less problematic.
I think so.
When you know what she's up to.
They're both jacked up.
Yeah. But I feel like it balances.
It does.
She is not a naive innocent.
Yeah.
Like she is an active player in this situation.
Yeah, let's get to the twist. It's a 60-year-old movie. Let's get to the twist. So it goes on for a while. He falls for her. He's trying to help her and he's falling deeper in love with her. They kiss a couple times. They get to that point where they're like, okay, we are in love with each other. Mm-hmm. And then she has what looks like an episode or a moment. She runs up the bell tower at the mission. That's one of the places where the grave is. And he tries to chase her. Great little, just the hook of the movie is so good. I feel like get the vertigo stuff at the beginning. It goes away forever.
Yeah.
Like forever. They talk about it where him and Midge are like, oh, I'll try to go up. And then it's gone for ages. And then the first time it comes back is when she runs up the bell tower. He can't make it. And then he sees her fall through the window and smush like road pizza. Right. Okay. So she dead. There's a little, the most like abbreviated courtroom drama sequence I've ever seen in my life.
Well, it's not even it's not a court.
It's like some kind of hearing. Somewhere.
Yeah. I forgot the name of it, but, you have a proceeding to decide whether or not this should go to trial.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And so then they decide.
It's gotta be a hearing, right?
Isn't it
an arraignment?
No.
These are words I've heard on Law and Order.
Here's the problem. I listen to too many true crime podcasts, yeah. And that means I should know.
It's either an arraignment or a hearing or a pre-trial trial or an exploration of evidence.
You know what? It is so interesting listening to you say words that aren't right and me not know the word that is right.
Yeah, she's saying no with absolutely no authority.
No, I'm right that you're wrong.
Okay, that might be true. Don't Google it. Don't cheat. Don't put your phone away. Just because this is a podcast doesn't mean you can cheat.
Oh, whatever.
Okay. Yeah, put it away.
All right.
Okay. So anyway, they decided suicide. Husband's like, I can't stay here. My wife killed herself here. I'm going to go. And you're like, that makes sense. I wouldn't stay. Okay. Two things are true. One, this movie does have a twist. And two, the twist even isn't what the movie is like fully about at the end to me. Like,
okay.
So the twist is the woman that he followed, interacted with, became infatuated with and fell in love with, was a body double that the husband hired to play the part of his wife so that Jimmy Stewart would buy into the mental illness stuff. And then when the husband threw the real wife off the roof dressed the same way, he knew he wouldn't make it to the top of the bell tower and he could get away scot-free. Mm-hmm. So he paid her off to play the part.
Well, yeah. So the husband has paid the Kim Novak character to basically help him murder his wife and to trick Jimmy Stewart into being, at the very best, a traumatized witness.
Yep.
And at the worst,
an
accomplice to murder.
Do you feel like that dramatic beat works? Like in the courtroom scene, that little moment they have afterwards where he walks up to him and he just says like, I'm sorry for what happened, if there's anything I can do. And Jimmy Stewart just says nothing. And just like stuck staring at the window.
And the husband's emotional reaction is wrong for someone whose wife has just died. Right.
Yeah.
It's not wrong for someone who's just killed his wife.
Now, did you remember the twist?
No. I remember that there was a twist.
And then you were kind of working your way to guessing it.
I was trying to. Yeah. So, and I knew it had something to do with her not being who she was presented to be.
Yeah,
So I kind of, I didn't remember all of it, but I remembered enough.
Okay. So he is despondent because he lost his new love. Mm-hmm. And also because he probably feels responsible that his friend's wife, you know, got squished like a grape.
Your similes are delightful.
There's a word that comes up in this movie out of the characters' mouths a lot. It's Kim Novak's line. Mm-hmm. It's Jimmy Stewart's line. And then it gets repeated over and over again. And that word is wandering. And so during that middle section, and I feel like even after the twist, when he's wandering a bit on his own and whatever, like this is when Hitchcock cares about the way things look and feel and not about how maybe the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed with the story.
Mm-hmm.
I think he wanted to capture what it felt like to like pick a city. And I read that he actually picked San Francisco because what do we know about San Francisco?
Hills.
And so you put the guy with vertigo in the city that has no flat ground.
Yeah.
So smart.
Okay. They put him in a mental hospital for a year. They imply that he's going to be there for 6 months to a year. Why?
Yeah.
Like, was that just to emphasize that he's not fully stable for the last act? Like, I didn't understand, I mean, why we needed that piece of the story.
It gives him and Midge another scene.
Yeah.
Which is really good. The one that where she's trying to play him the music.
Yeah.
And, her line at the end of that scene is like, I'll tell you another thing. He was in love with her and he still is.
Yeah.
So I think the intent of that, and I feel like it works by the time you get to the end, because if you build up how real his falling in love with her was,
right.
At least in his mind, then by the time he figures out the twist at the end and his betrayal from her,
right.
It I'm not saying it justifies everything that he does in the last 15 minutes of the movie, but it justifies it from a story perspective.
Right.
Now, I just want to say about what this movie says. Okay, because we really got to get to that. What is this movie saying? By the way, at the end,
He realizes she was, he meets this other woman who looks mm-hmm. like her. He goes through this whole process of like making her back into Madeline.
Mm-hmm. Having her dye her hair, changing her wardrobe.
Yeah.
Changing her makeup.
Not knowing
all of that.
Not knowing it really is her. And she admits that in voiceover for us, mm-hmm. She admits that she really did fall in love with him. The reason she didn't run as soon as he recognized her again is because she couldn't. She mm-hmm. loved him too. Mm-hmm. He figures it out because she puts on a necklace that Carlotta wore. And then in the end, he makes it all the way to the top of the bell tower.
He does.
Dragging her all the way. And there's a really good shot of her shoes getting dragged up. Mm-hmm. That's really creepy. And then at the end, in a very Hitchcock way, the only real like scary thing in the movie to me is the image of the silhouetted nun just like rising up from nothing.
Yeah.
I don't know. It got me at least. And then she falls.
Yes, she does.
She just falls.
She does. And then...
So what the heck is it about? What's it saying? What do you got?
Well, I think part of it is, as Hitchcock said to Kim Novak, it's not about the story, it's about the visuals. So that's a piece of what's going on here.
It looks pretty.
It is beautiful yeah. and highly symbolic. Like,
yeah.
I have been on this kick of watching movies I loved as a kid again, even, mm-hmm. you know, that I haven't seen for a very long time. And so I rewatched South Pacific a couple months ago.
I remember hearing about it.
Yeah. And I hated it.
Yeah.
Not all of it. There were some okay moments, but that was made the same year, 1958.
Yep.
And both of these movies are trying to take advantage of Technicolor, and Vertigo's doing it right. And South Pacific is doing it wrong mm-hmm. by just putting like 17 different color filters. And Vertigo uses color filters yep. during dream his sequence. In a dream sequence.
Yeah,
which,
come on. Yeah.
Like, I'll give him that.
Yeah. What we're talking about color filters, like these days you push buttons on a computer to recolorize things. Back then it's a physical like cylinder of like plastic or glass that literally goes over the mm-hmm. lens. So it's mm-hmm. like, it's not like a subtle, it's like green or blue or red. Yeah.
And so I think this movie it's saying more through its visuals and through its symbolism than maybe it is through its script.
And there's not that much dialogue.
No, there really isn't. But I do think this has something to do with obsession and even just the fallout of the consequences, right?
Yep.
Like, that this husband has decided he wants to kill his wife so that he can be free again. And so he creates this whole narrative, and the Kim Novak character decides she wants the cash. And so she's going to
yep.
assist this man in killing his wife, for the money. And kind of this, like, there's consequences for that. Like, mm-hmm. like you make these terrible decisions and you agree to align yourself with evil and it's gonna come back on you. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's what I see. What do you think happens to this Jimmy Stewart character when this movie's over?
Probably stays away from stairs for a while.
Because we leave him framed in the giant window.
Such a good shot.
Doorway-sized window at the top of the bell tower.
He looks right over the ledge, and he doesn't look dizzy, which is the weirdest thing about the movie.
Well, but that's it. Because at the beginning, Midge said, the doctor said you might be cured if you have a similarly emotional experience at a height or something like that. And now he has.
Yeah.
And
I guess that's... I didn't even realize that wasn't... That's nicely...
Now the vertigo's gone.
Actually, that's a nice Hitchcock thing.
And so
thing.
I'm like... I mean, there's part of me that's like, does he fling himself off that ledge? But I don't think he does.
I almost feel like, I don't know. I this is a super complicated movie to me, mm-hmm. like character-wise, morality-wise, whatever. What I noticed in the movie and what like kept, I noticed it early-ish on as soon as the retirement part of the story mm-hmm. came in to play. He's like, I don't want to retire, mm-hmm. but I can't sit behind a desk all day mm-hmm. and I can't chase criminals upstairs. Okay. So mm-hmm. it's that part of the plot. Plus the fact that it is an older Jimmy Stewart.
Right.
Right. Than we've seen in color, in like HD color. Like I watched it on, I bought it on Apple TV. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it was like rent for $4, buy for $5. Easiest choice in the world.
Yeah, no, I did the same thing.
So I bought it for $5 and it looks amazing.
No, it's so good.
But
it's like, okay, it's older Jimmy Stewart and he's got some makeup on and he's got some lines on his forehead, right? So I'm immediately thinking like, okay, this is about, this is a middle-aged man.
Yeah.
This is midlife, right? And they're putting in the story that this is a cop who is forced into retirement. Now, I know some people in my direct sphere who have had gone through this exact same thing for a couple reasons. It is a huge like blow to your, like, of course, you your career, like whatever you wanted to be your dream career, whatever that might be. If it gets derailed, you just have like an existential crisis moment.
Yeah. Where you're
like,
identity, purpose.
Don't know what to do all next. That stuff. And people, men especially, tend to, when they're going through their midlife crises, this is when most people get divorced, most affairs happen, most convertibles get purchased, you know, all of that. But like the stage of life that this character is in is purely, I mean, you could just argue it is this movie is this man's midlife crisis. And Madeline, and subsequently Judy Madeline, is the thing.
Yeah.
Most guys who go through that fixate on one thing, it's like, well, if I can just fill in the blank, the rest of my life will have some meaning, or the next few years of my life will have some meaning or some purpose. And a lot of guys find their way to a woman, whether it's, you know, the woman that they're married to, whatever. And so the fact that this is illicit, like that he is in fact falling in love with someone who's allegedly married, and the fact that like he feels so betrayed when she comes back and it's like, oh, you didn't die. Like, you were my thing.
Yeah.
Right. You were my bounce off the backboard into my next stage of life.
Right.
And you tricked me. You know what I mean? There's the infatuation of it and the idea to me for Hitchcock is, shouldn't be anyone's model for like, you know, how to view, handle, treat, care for other people,
specifically young blonde women.
Yep. And so there's, I think whether he wanted to or not, and I think he probably didn't care if he did or not because he was that kind of a guy. There's a lot of autobiographical threads in here. Like I said, the clothing sequence where he's like saying like, that is wrong. You have to wear this other one is literally what happened to Kim Novak, which lots of directors have specific ideas, but you put those two things next to each other and you're like, come on, man, like you don't have to be Freud to figure this one out.
Right.
And so I think it's about a midlife. I think it's, this is, Jimmy Stewart's midlife crisis. And I think she is a flawed character because she takes the money and does the horrible, horrible thing, which is so insane to play the part and trick the guy and traumatize him for some money. And in the end, I'm like, I don't know. They're both terrible for anyone.
Well, so we talked about, when I was here talking about, of Humphrey Bogart and Audrey Hepburn in Sabrina.
Yep.
That was
the age difference.
But I was trying to remember what that age difference was. Like he was in his 50s and she was in her 20s. It was like a 30 year age gap. 28
years, if I'm not mistaken, something like that.
This is slightly
25.
Yeah, this is 25 years, which was the exact age difference between Humphrey Bogart and his then wife. But that's another story. Lauren Bacall. But this, I feel like, doesn't read as creepy as that. It's 5 years shorter. Kim Novak looks older, right? Audrey Hepburn looks like a teenager.
Yeah.
Kim Novak could be in her mid-30s.
Yeah.
If you told me she was supposed to be 35, I'd buy it. And Kim Novak's character, whether we're calling her Madeline or Judy, has agency. She has made decisions.
Yeah.
She is active in this world. In fact, at the beginning, she's pulling one over on him.
Yep.
Like he's the innocent, naive one.
Yeah.
And she's the one tricking him. And so I know you were referencing earlier that some people think that this is about, you know, an older man exerting his power inappropriately over a younger woman, but I don't.
Or like it's a voyeuristic, like this is Hitchcock making the audience try to sympathize with him.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Like, that's slightly different.
If Jimmy Stewart is some sort of more likable analog for who Alfred Hitchcock was, then like at the end, it's Jimmy Stewart. And like they've made it he's made it complicated enough where like you're not looking at Jimmy Stewart like, good, you got what you deserved.
Right.
It's not that simple.
No.
It's also not like, oh man, I feel so bad for him. It's like, it's not that simple.
No.
It's a lot of stuff.
Right. Because he responds so badly.
Oh, he loses it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other irony of it is like it's a little bit the trope of the hysterical woman where like people say you might be crazy and she's saying I am not mad.
Right.
Right. So that's like a common literary trope, but also it's in movies and stuff that's happening. I do think that this is a movie full of uncomfortable sequences, but none of it adds up to like those uncomfortable sequences devalue the final product for me, the final story, like where it lands, because like watching him figure it out and drag her out of the car and drag her up the stairs. It's not even just that though. Forget before he knows when he's making her wear those clothes and he like makes her put her hair up in a bun. Mm-hmm. He literally says like, they have conversations where couldn't you like me? Like just me. And so I feel like I don't know what Hitchcock's view on Johnny, John Scotty, who calls a John Scotty just
it's because he's Scottish.
Whatever. Like they never say that.
Well, is it McPherson?
I don't know. They don't talk about his last name that much.
He's Scottish.
He's like, some people call me John. Some people call me Scotty. You call me whatever you want. It's like, those are two names.
It's because he's Scottish.
It's stupid and I hate it.
You're just mad because you didn't notice.
I'm Scottish.
Yes, you are.
No one calls me Scotty.
What if I started doing that at work?
That would be really confusing.
It would be.
I don't know what Hitchcock thinks about this guy as a character. I don't know if he thinks he's more sympathetic than I do. But what I do know is the definition of love that's in this movie is freaking warped to me. Like there's the idea, the like literary idea of falling in love, right? Which I give some grace to when I'm reading a story, watching a movie, like, okay, maybe that's not exactly how I would do that, but I give room. I just like, by the time you get to the end and she's saying those things, like, if I let you change me, will you love me? Mm-hmm. And it's like, if you can't fall in love with Judy,
right?
Or fall in love with Madeline again as Judy.
Just Judy. It's Judy.
If you can't fall in love with Judy, then she later says, I want to make you fall in love with me again.
Right.
If you can't do that, then it's not, to me, this is not love. Right. No. There's a power dynamic here that he is forcing upon her. And then that comes to fruition when he drags her up the stairs that like, there's no way any of this was going to end well.
No, I think that Midge loves him at the beginning.
Yes.
And I think that Judy loves him at the end. I don't think he loves anybody in this. I think he has obsession.
Yes.
And maybe I think he has a general affection for Midge. And I think he has a,
because of his midlife crisis,
he has an obsession. Yeah. But I don't think that has anything to do with this, you know, whether we're calling her Madeline or Judy, like it doesn't have anything to do with her as a human being. It's her as icon, right? This is the icon. What I do find interesting, because I'm a word nerd, is Madeline is French for Magdalene, like we would Mary Magdalene.
Okay.
And I'm so sorry. Just ignore me, listeners. But Magdalene, Mary Magdalene was named after the town of Migdal, and the word Migdal means tower. The word Madeline, if you go back far enough in its etymology, literally means
such a nerd
tower.
But that one landed.
Yeah, that one landed.
I'll give you that one.
In the French
landed. Sorry.
In the French version of this story, that was based on the character of Judy. Her name was Renee, and Renee means rebirth, and changing it to Judy is stupid. Like Renee is a name we understand in English.
Everyone knows a Renee.
And so she goes from being the tower, the icon, the object of worship to being reborn into a human. That's brilliant.
That's pretty good.
Stop calling her Judy.
Yeah.
Stupid Hollywood.
Judy. What a dumb name. Sorry, all the Judys out there. Your name's dumb.
It does not carry the symbolic resonance of Renee.
And he thinks your name is dumb.
Be nice to the Judy.
Agreed. I think, I don't know. For me, this is exactly the kind of like morally complicated, you know, icky feeling, but also gorgeous to behold movies that is so like worth the effort.
Yeah,
it takes a little effort because like you are watching Jimmy Stewart make a left, make a right, turn, have a puzzled look on his face. But there's not like a single shot of this movie that is like extra, that is extraneous.
No.
It's all very purposeful, even though the chess pieces don't move quickly.
No.
Like at all.
There's a shot early on in Midge's apartment where like, and it's a nothing shot. Like it doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
And it's Jimmy Stewart and he's like sitting on like the corner of her leather sofa and he's just like leaning back on one elbow while they talk. And it's art. Like
you'd hang it on the wall.
Yeah. It's just this picture of him like reclined on this couch and it is the most beautiful visual. And it's not even it's meaningful.
Just an apartment. Yeah.
It's just two characters having a conversation and creating characterization really. Yeah. And
they're so good in those scenes, like you said, to bring it full circle at the end of the what's it saying section. I think like it's a tragedy. This movie is just it's a tragic story on several levels. But I think the thing that's saddest about it is that you start with him and Midge and it's the most human, warm, kind, like functional thing that happens socially for him, emotionally for him in the whole story. And he just doesn't see it. He doesn't see who she is. He doesn't see her from the wall.
No.
You know, the only time he like seeks her out again is when he needs to find information, right? Is when he's like, hey, you know anybody who knows anybody? Take me to him right now. You know, it's like, and she's just like, she's there and she's real. And this is a real person.
So this movie's on all the lists, right?
Yeah.
Best of whatever. And I didn't look it up, but it's on the list of a bunch of like best love story movies.
Oh, that ain't right.
And I'm just like, this is not a love story. Like that is just because you have these two characters who are kissing each other
in front of the ocean.
In a stable.
Yeah, or in a stable.
Like,
which is a smelly place to kiss someone, is, just for the record.
It is.
But although like, there was only a fake horse.
Oh, that's true.
He knocked on it. Yeah.
I just don't understand how anyone watches this movie and like does the like noise. Like there's nothing romantic.
There's not a swoon to be
had. No, there is no moment where I'm like, oh, Jimmy. Like, no.
I'll say, like, he looks hunky. He's a good looking older man.
The blue eyes are working in the Technicolor.
Guacamole, they're piercing. And she is like otherworldly beautiful.
Right.
But apart from those two things, which is like, okay, if you smush these two characters together in the same space, there should be like electricity. And it's like there's on screen chemistry, but it's not that kind.
No.
It's like you don't want her to fall for him or him to fall for her. Mm-mm. You don't want him to go deeper into her weird, freaky mind. You don't want any of it.
No.
You know what I mean? And it's one of those movies where characters just keep doing things where you're like, oh, stop it. Like, stop doing that. Like,
well, and it reminds me of Frances Ha, which is radically different movie.
Yeah.
But in the same sense, you're watching her being like, don't do that thing.
Yes.
Don't do that thing.
Yes.
Like, because she's just socially awkward and messing up all the time. But then at the end, she learns something and she becomes a better person at the end at Frances Ha. But in this, you're just watching them descend into madness and death. And
the longer she keeps the secret as Judy, you're like, every scene ratchets and gets to worse and worse territory, because you see her like start to write the letter and then she balls up and she tells you the whole story. By the way, Hitchcock's a brilliant director, one of the best to ever do the thing. One thing he's really clunky at is like, there'll be like an amazing movie and then they'll just be like exposition for like 2 minutes straight.
Yeah.
And he's not the only one in the world who does that, but Psycho has a really famous scene too, where like the entire movie happens. And at the end, there's like a group of psychiatrists all being like, well, here's what we think happened with Norman Bates. And it's kind of exhausting.
Yeah.
Like, so I think this is better in this because the camera moves interestingly and it's more dreamy and she's sort of but anyway, every time she decides not to run away or tell him right away, I'm sorry, like this is what happened. Because you just think like after all of the, he's getting more obsessive.
Yeah.
And she waits until, she doesn't even tell him. She waits until he figures it out and then she goes, I'm so sorry. It's like, oh, you're screwed. Like,
and he's waiting in her apartment and I keep going, look in the closet.
Yes.
Look in the closet.
Yeah.
Look at, and he never did.
Yeah. There are Hitchcock tense moments in this, but it's not like the heart rate monitor pacing of them as you see in other ones, right? Like where he's like probably every few minutes you need to have one good sequence where you're like,
well, you know. I just know that like Rear Window
is like so good for that.
Bad for my blood pressure, right? Like
it's spooky.
It is.
Yeah.
But this doesn't do that.
I feel like only in the like the whole thing has like a creeping dread to it.
Yes.
But no one moment is like, except for the nun thing got me for a moment.
Yeah.
But it's not even trying to be like the shower scene or anything like that.
No.
No, he's not really broken.
Well, and then you like, they get startled by the nun and she falls out the window and dies. But then like when they show him, there's like this huge ledge.
Yeah.
And I'm like, honey, you have, you are.
Well, and that's why I think it's smart. They don't show her falling.
No.
They just, you hear it and then he looks down.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's a couple little cheats in this movie of like realism. Mm-hmm. This is not a movie about a lot of realism.
I'm just going to say where she falls into the bay. You can't fall in the bay right there. Like you just can't.
Well, she jumped.
Oh, that is true. She jumped. I love when he's getting mad at her and he's like, I bet you're a really excellent swimmer.
Yeah.
And she goes, well, yeah. I don't know why I thought that was funny, but I did.
Okay, let's wrap it up. What do we think? We've said what we think it's saying. I think. Is there anything else you want to add before we tell people whether or not it's worth their time?
I think it's a bit of a love letter to San Francisco.
Yeah,
I think maybe you and I enjoy it a smudge more than maybe some other people would, just because it's our hometown, more or less.
Yeah,
you know, like I can, as you were saying, like when they're driving through the eucalyptus trees, I'm like, oh, I love that part of. Yep. Of one or 101.
Yeah.
And so I do think that maybe boosts our enjoyment of it a little bit.
I think that helps. I don't think San Francisco has nearly as many like iconic San Francisco movies as New York has New York movies. There's a lot, but there's not captured this like realistically, even with 16 days of shooting. You know what I mean? Like there's probably a lot of movies that take place in San Francisco where you could kind of copy and paste a chase scene or a dialogue scene. It's like, I don't know where they shot that in a soundstage somewhere.
But isn't this coming off noir? Because San Francisco is the noir city, right?
Yeah.
San Francisco, at least originally.
Chicago and San Francisco.
And LA. Well, and you have Chandler and Hammett. They're writing about San Francisco and LA.
What's the made up one?
Oh, they combine it. So it's
San Fernangelis or something like that.
I forget how they do it, but they combine the two.
New Francisco.
No, there's no new.
Chicagisco.
But I think this is in San Francisco, partly like you said, the hills, but I think it's a nod to noir as well. And the noir private eye. Because even if you think about like the Maltese Falcon, doesn't the Maltese Falcon all takes place within San Francisco all takes place within three blocks.
You talk about the Maltese Falcon and people aren't like, oh yeah, that great San Francisco movie. They're like, it's a Humphrey Bogart movie.
Yeah. You know? But then they take the drive down the anyway.
They do.
I think there are hints towards classic noir in this.
Yeah, no, I think that's true.
And that San Francisco is part of that.
And I like the idea that it's like the story after the normal noir story. You know what I mean? Like that's not how we see a noir story start, was a cop retiring or a private eye being like, I have to stop being this altogether. That's more like a Western subplot. You know, it's like hanging up the spurs.
And I feel like those noir detectives are always on the brink of quitting.
Well,
and they're all
drinking themselves to death.
And they're all former cops.
That's
true. You know.
Okay. Is it worth people's time?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think so too.
I think I watched it over 2 days. I think that was okay.
Yeah.
Like
you could split it up if you wanted to, and it wouldn't really hurt the movie because its pacing is deliberate.
And I think I accidentally split it at a good moment.
Yeah.
Like I split it when.
Where'd you split it?
Before the reveal.
Okay.
So like they were still bopping around San Francisco in wearing lots of green.
So before she falls.
No, after she falls in the water.
Oh, before the Judy reveal, not the death part.
Yeah, okay. Before the Judy reveal.
It's kind of weird to talk about it and even think like, oh yeah, and they kill off Kim Novak halfway through the movie.
Yeah.
Because Hitchcock just does that to people.
He
just kills them.
Yeah. So I loved this. I thought the visuals were astonishing and such good use of symbolism. And anyway, I thought it was an incredible movie. Like we said earlier, I'm more likely to watch Citizen Kane again. I'm more likely to watch Rear Window again.
Francis Ha.
Well, I don't know. Maybe not.
Sabrina.
No. No. Although, listeners, I need to come back with an update. When I recorded Sabrina, I said what I needed to do was go back and watch the 90s version.
Uh-huh.
I did my own homework.
Yep, yep, yep.
So much better.
Oh, okay.
So much. It's like a B.
Except for, you said
it's
one thing.
It's a B plus. Like, I'm not, yeah, yeah. I'm not saying it's an extraordinary movie, but like.
It's fine.
It's fine. And it's like, you know, you're bored on a Saturday
night.
Oh,
they kept the It's All in the Family.
Oh, they kept.
Oh, come on. It's got to be a C.
They kept the worst line. Yeah. But then.
Harrison Ford.
Harrison Ford gets slapped in the face for it.
Yeah.
So it's not like cute. It's like,
okay, that's
you
better.
Jerk.
That's
so
better.
How dare you say that to me, you jerk. So yeah,
that's a bad line.
Yeah. But anyway, so it gets a B plus.
Vertigo.
The 90s version of Sabrina gets a B plus.
Okay.
The 50s version of Sabrina fails. Yeah. No, I really liked, I really like this.
How often would you rewatch it?
Well, I went 20 years this time. That was too much.
Once every 20 years.
I can watch it.
If we could see this on the big screen,
I would go
in
tomorrow.
San Francisco, that would be amazing.
Yeah.
It would be awesome.
I would see it anytime on the big screen because I think that's what it's made for.
Yeah.
But I don't know, a few years.
This is one of those old movies that, yes, it's worth your time, by the way. It's worth your time. You should watch it. It's one of the best looking things you'll ever watch. Mm-hmm. It's so nice to look at. And like, it's not a feel good story, but it's a good tragedy. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a good tragic mm-hmm. story with flawed, complicated characters that, you know, tragedies sometimes just have a bunch of people you hate in them. And then you mm-hmm. kind of feel like you wasted your time at the end and everybody sucks and everybody dies or what bad guy wins. And you're like, why did I watch that? Or why did I read that or whatever? This is not one of those. This is more complicated and more worth your time for those reasons. I was just going to say on a more technical note, I think it's worth your time because it's a rare movie that I watch that's this old
mm-hmm.
that the like upscaling, the restoration, the HD-ness of it is like, it's got to be like 100 times better than when you saw it in the theater in 1958.
Well, they did a huge
remaster
in the 90s.
Yeah.
And then again and recently.
It's because of the colors. But it's also because of the use of like widescreen and the cityscapes, the big shots, the driving shots, just the, like you were saying, mm-hmm. the framing of stuff that shouldn't be gorgeous. Mm-hmm. Them sitting in an apartment, her looking at a painting, like watch it like today because it looks like more amazing than it probably ever has on your giant TV at home mm-hmm. or if you could see it in theaters. But yeah, watch Vertigo. Fall down the tower with us. It's great. Okay, well, we made it all the way up to the tower, mm-hmm. and we're going to start a new thing next week.
We are.
And
the podcast is.
Well, this is past and future guest, Annie Nelson.
Yes,
she'll be
it
back.
Is.
And the new series, you had a little help in pushing us across the finish line.
You guys, it was my idea.
It was basically your idea.
It was entirely my idea.
It was sort of your idea.
It was thoroughly my idea.
And it's going to be our mom's. Pick the
Yours
movies
and Justin's.
Series. So our moms are recommending these movies and we'll see you next week. Bye.
Let the movie speak.
No. No. I heard voices. God have mercy.
Hey, since you're still here and still listening, thank you, by the way, we'd like to ask an additional favor of you.
We have social media. It's a thing on the internet. And all you need to do is find us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and like and subscribe. I know this is annoying, but we have to ask you because we want more people to hear the show. In addition to that, if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we would greatly appreciate it. See you next week. Bye.